you, Megan. Good afternoon, everybody. So I'm going to talk to you today about primary care physician perspectives on immunization of adults aged 19 to 64 years. And I would just recognize other members of the project team, Sarah Clark, Gary Fried, who's in the house, I believe, and Maggie Coleman at the CDC. I'm just going to provide a little bit of background. A lot of this you probably already know, but there's been an increased emphasis on adult vaccination in recent years. As an example of this, in 2007, the Annals of Internal Medicine first published the recommended adult immunization schedule, and that's something they plan to update annually. So this is a great way to increase visibility of this schedule. And hopefully will be a useful resource to adult providers who may not be avid readers of MMWR. There's been a lot of expansion in vaccine recommendations for adults in recent years, both new vaccines like Zoster and broadening of recommendations like the age expansions for flu. And really a lot of focus in past years, people, when they think about adult vaccines, think about vaccines for those 65 and older. And I think with the expansions and new vaccines, we've really moved beyond that to also include the 19 to 64-year-olds. Adults have low vaccine coverage rates. Based on 2007 data, TD was 57% among those 18 to 64, and that's the best one. Flu at that time frame was about 40%, and the rest of them, most of them are much lower than that. And just one other point I wanted to make was that unlike other pharmaceuticals that adult providers are used to dealing with, vaccines have to be purchased up front. So that's just sort of one barrier unique to getting vaccines in the primary care setting. Here is the adult immunization schedule, and I put up the 2009 simply because that was the year of this study. And I just wanted to say a couple things. You know, it's not necessarily straightforward, and there's the wide range of ages, and you have a vaccine like HPV really focused on the younger end, something like Zoster, which is only on the older end. And then you can't really, oh, I guess you can up there, can't hear, the purple. The partial and full bars of purple are those that are recommended if other risk factors are present. So that adds another layer of complexity to figuring out which of your patients need vaccines. So what's going on in private provider practices related to adult immunizations? We were here a couple years ago presenting some work in the pediatric setting on childhood vaccines, where we surveyed providers on vaccines and particularly financing issues, and we thought, I wonder if we could do something similar with adult providers. And so as we were thinking about it, it got to the point where we're like, well, we can, but we really have to bring this back to a more basic level because so much more is unknown with adult providers. So with that in mind, we set out to determine the proportion of adult primary care physicians that stock vaccines for adults 19 to 64 years, and we wanted to explore their reasons for not stocking certain vaccines, as well as exploring barriers to administering the vaccines that they do stock. So we did a cross-sectional national mail survey, and we pulled our sample from the AMA master file, which is a comprehensive U.S. listing of both AMA members and non-members, and it gives you verified U.S. mailing addresses and some basic demographic information to go along with the physicians. We specifically pulled family physicians and general internists in office-based direct patient care and excluded things like residents, people with subspecialty board listings, and ended up with a sample of 1,990 physicians in our final sample. We developed a four-page, 15-item survey that was fielded just about a year ago, April through June 2009. We do three mailings a few weeks apart. The first one gets a little small cash incentive, and it's always the mailing we get the largest response to. And with the data we got, we ran some frequencies and bivariates using SAS. That's what I'll show you today. First, our response rate, 59% hire for family physicians and internists, but actually we were quite pleased with our internist response rate because they're notoriously hard to get to respond to surveys. Of those who responded, 80% of them said they provide primary care to adults aged 19 to 64 years, much higher among family physicians than internists. And this was just a yes-no question, so we don't know, was it the primary care part, was it the age range? We're not sure, you know, what's the thing that made people respond no to that? And we call these our eligible respondents. And of those, almost all of them actually said they regularly stock at least one vaccine for adults aged 19 to 64 years. And there was no difference in that proportion by specialty. And to give you some practice characteristics for our eligible respondents, first practice size, where we have broke it down into categories by number of physicians. And that was pretty evenly spread out, with family physicians going more to the smaller size, and then internists kind of smaller or larger, not so much in the middle. The majority of practices were single specialty versus multi-specialty. And the majority were also considered themselves private independent practice. Another category there, the next most common, was 20% of the practices said they were owned or affiliated with a hospital or a medical center. We also asked respondents to tell us the proportion of their patient population in three age categories. And that's a little hard to operationalize across respondents, but looking at the mean, and if you look in that overall column, so that's across all respondents, the average patient profile showed about half of the patients being 19 to 64 years, about a third in the 65 years and older, and then 14% 0 to 18 years. And as you might expect for family physicians, the average patient profile showed a higher proportion of children and adolescents, and for internists, a lot fewer kids and a lot more of the 65 and older. And as I said before, almost all said they did stock at least one vaccine, but of those, that small subgroup that didn't stock any vaccines for adults age 19 to 64 years, we asked them why. And the most common reason they gave was that vaccines are available elsewhere in their community, like community agencies in Massachusetts. The next most common reasons all relate to cost reimbursement issues, inventory cost, inadequate reimbursement, inconsistent insurance coverage. And then a few others said they didn't have enough patients for whom these vaccines are indicated, or that adult patients don't want vaccines. So that was all that we asked for from that small subgroup who don't stock any vaccine. So the rest of what I'm talking about will focus on those that who do stock at least one vaccine for adults, and that's there are 849 folks in that group. So first, we'll take a look at some immunization-related characteristics. We asked them, to what extent are you involved in your practice's decisions about vaccine purchase? And almost half said they're directly involved in these decisions. And we call these folks decision makers. And the other 51% we call non-decision makers. And this we'll use in our bivariates, as you'll soon see. The other, of those 51% non-decision makers, 30% said they're indirectly involved. They do provide input to the decision makers, but have no direct decision making themselves. And 21% said they're not involved at all in vaccine purchase decisions for their practice. There was no difference in the proportion who said they're directly involved across specialties, so that was the same for both family physicians and internists. We asked them at what organizational level vaccine purchase decisions are made for their practice, and about two-thirds said it happens within their own practice, 32% at some level above them, a parent organization, a practice network, and this was a question where they could select more than one response. 2% had other responses, and 4% said they didn't know. If you look at this by decision-making status, the picture changes a little bit. You can see that the decision-makers are saying, which I guess makes sense since they are decision-makers, that most decision-makers are saying, we do this at our own practice level. And a lot more of the non-decision makers indicate that this happens outside of their practice. We asked them the extent that their practice participates in a purchasing cooperative or a buying group for the adult vaccines that they purchase. And 30% said they participate to some extent, 90% for all of the adult vaccines they purchase, and 11% for some of them. 39% don't participate in one at all, and 31% didn't know, which a lot of that group is made up of the non-decision makers, as you might expect. And so that not really a focus of our study, but to kind of anchor this with a vaccine that providers would be most familiar with, we asked a couple of questions about influenza, and almost all of them told us they stock injectable influenza, and only a quarter stock nasal. And we asked them about their plans for the upcoming season, and over half said they expected to stock the same number of influenza doses. 33% thought they'd stock more, and 4% thought they'd reduce the number of doses they'd had from the previous season. And at the time of the survey, this was about when they would have ordered or would be ordering for the 2009-2010 season, and also was before issues related to H1N1 vaccine really hit, so that wasn't sort of complicating that. So this is a list of all the other vaccines on the adult immunization schedule. And so for each of these, we went down the list and said, do you regularly stock this vaccine for adults age 19 to 64 years, yes or no? So we looked at Hep A, Hep B, HPV, MMR, meningococcal, pneumococcal, TD, Tdap, varicella, and zoster. And looking at their responses, and this is sorted in descending order of yes, we stock. TD and pneumococcal pop up to the top of the list, which isn't too surprising. They're very long-standing recommendations. And as you work your way down, zoster at the bottom is the one vaccine where less than half of our respondents said they stock that vaccine. Now, looking at this differences by specialty, you'll see that for almost all of them, family physicians are more likely to stock the vaccines. And within internists, the order changes a little bit if you're sorting by descending order by yes stocking. So the zoster is not at the bottom of the list. Actually, meningococcal and varicella are less frequently stocked by internists that responded to our survey. By decision-making status, there's sort of an interesting trend where the decision makers actually less commonly stock these vaccines. And in fact, looks like six of them, less than half of respondents, that said their decision makers say they stock these vaccines. And so one explanation could be that decision makers are just more likely to know which vaccines they actually stock. Or it could be that practices where they're making decisions at the practice level are truly less likely to have as many products. Across all the vaccines, we looked at, of all the respondents that had no missing values, a very clear-cut yes or no response for all 10 of those vaccines, 27% stocked all 10 of the vaccines. And similar to the trends for the individual vaccines, family physicians were more likely to stock all of them, and decision makers were less likely. 41% stocked 6 to 9 of those vaccines, and 32% stocked 5 or fewer. Now, for each individual vaccine, we asked them reasons for not stocking. So among those who said, I don't stock this vaccine, what are the reasons? So we gave them these six listed here: inadequate reimbursement, inconsistent insurance coverage, high inventory cost, patients receive elsewhere, few patients for whom indicated, and patients don't want. And then if those reasons didn't fit, there was a comment area where they could give additional reasons. And I can't fit all 10 vaccines with all six reasons on one slide, so I'm not expecting to digest these tables. Just so you know, what I have highlighted in yellow is the most common reason for that vaccine. So for TD, for example, the most common reasons for saying I don't stock it is because I've got few patients for whom it's indicated. You will notice going through it, this is the next block of vaccines. Nothing really stands out as like a huge, very significant reason, and the patients don't want is much lower than the others. The last one with varicella and zoster. And I can flip back if you need to want to look at anything in specific, but just to summarize, there was only one instance where a majority of the people who didn't stock vaccine gave a single reason, so, and that was for zoster. 58% of those folks who don't stock zoster said it was because of its high inventory cost. And if you look across the vaccines, of those ones that were highlighted in yellow, there were three main reasons. So high inventory cost was the main reason for people not stocking Hep B, HPV, meningococcal. Actually, meningococcal is a mistake. Don't look at that. Hep B, HPV, pneumococcal, and zoster. Few patients for whom the vaccine was indicated were the most common reasons for not stocking Hep A, MMR, meningococcal, TD, and varicella. And then inadequate reimbursement was the main reason for not stocking pneumococcal and Tdap. Again, we looked at this by specialty. Family physicians were more likely than internists to report a few of these reasons for a few vaccines. So, and actually, the top three are the cost reimbursement related reasons, and it affects three of the vaccines, so HPV, meningococcal, and varicella. They also were more likely to say that the reason they don't stock zoster is because patients don't want it. And internists were more likely than family physicians to report that they don't stock TD because patients receive it elsewhere, and they don't stock HPV, MMR, meningococcal, Tdap, and varicella because there's few patients for whom it's indicated. So it's interesting that there's three of the same vaccines, HPV, meningococcal, and varicella, and they have different reasons for not stocking them. We also looked at it by decision-making status. And similar to the family physicians, decision makers were more likely than non-decision makers to have these three financial related reasons pop up to the top for some of the vaccines. They also said that they didn't stock TD because they have few patients for whom it's indicated. So those were the reasons for not stocking specific vaccines. We also asked them, for those vaccines that you do stock, what are the extent of problems that your practice has? We gave them these seven specific issues. Reimbursement for vaccine products, patients declining due to out-of-pocket costs, reimbursement for administration using vaccine by expiration dates, making vaccines a clinical priority, complying with storage protocols, and knowing which patients need vaccines. So these are sorted in order of major problem, in descending order. So reimbursement for vaccine project had the highest proportion say that that's a major problem. And actually, the top four reasons listed here have the majority, over 50%, saying there's at least some problem. But nothing pops up as over 50% in the problem, two problem columns, although almost 50% said that patients declining vaccine due to cost was a minor problem. But as you can see, the three cost issues are at the top of the list. Again, we do a cut by specialty and a cut by decision makers. For both family physicians and decision makers, the things that they were more likely to say is a major problem than their comparison group was the three cost reimbursement related issues and using vaccines by their expiration date. And this was really the minor problem, proportions were pretty similar, so it's really just looking at major problem versus not a problem. We also asked folks what they thought their practice would do next year in terms of the number of different vaccines that they would stock for adults 19 to 64 years. And just about 80% said they're likely to stock the same number of different vaccines, and 12% said they would likely to increase that number. Another 7 said they would probably decrease, and 1% said they're likely to stop stocking any vaccines at all for this population. But when you look at this by decision-making status, it's interesting because decision makers were less likely to say that things were gonna stay the status quo. All of the other categories are increased, so more said it would increase, more said it would decrease, and more said they would stop. And you would think that decision makers would be the ones involved in these discussions about what the practice was going to be doing. So I think those numbers are pretty interesting to look at. All right, let's see here. So it was a male survey, so there's always the potential for response bias. Those who responded may be more interested in immunizations in general and may also be more likely to stock vaccines, in which case what we've shown would be a best case scenario for stocking. The limited amount of demographic information we do have, well, we do compare respondents and non-respondents and didn't find any differences on those variables. We did focus only on family physicians and internists, and many adults may rely more on subspecialists who may be even less likely to stock vaccines. And it's not on the slide, but obviously male surveys are self-report, and so you have to take folks on their word about the vaccines that they say they do or don't stock. I really don't think anyone took our survey form to their fridge and checked off the boxes, but, and also the fact that they self-identified as decision makers or not. So some take-home messages. Many adult primary care physicians do not stock all the recommended adult vaccines, and this was a bigger issue for internists, and more stark differences when you looked at decision makers, where they had six vaccines that were stocked by less than half of the respondents. Immunizations are an important component of preventive care, so it is important to encourage the stocking of vaccines. And it may be worth looking at whether there's a particular subset of physicians that aren't stocking certain vaccines and may be causing some inequitable access for certain kinds of populations. No single dominant reason for not stocking was shown, but for many vaccines there was definitely a financial slant to why they weren't stocked. Financial aspects were also more likely to be problems with vaccines that are stocked. So while it wouldn't be the entire solution, addressing some of the financing issues related to adult vaccines would certainly be a big help. Another issue is it's difficult to address vaccines for which few patients are indicated. Physicians have to order these up front, often in bulk, lay out the money, and if they don't use them, they expire. So is it really appropriate to expect that all of those vaccines on the schedule are routinely stocked? The good news is that most that do stock vaccines are planning to continue to do so. And as we showed in this study, decision makers often have a different perspective, so that's valuable to take that into account when you're looking at the business end of practice issues like vaccine purchase decisions. So just to wrap up, this work was funded by the CDC, and our little disclaimer that the findings and conclusions are those of us. And that's my contact information, and we will now take questions.
So if you can come to the microphone that's in the middle of the room there with questions and give your name and where you're from, we have plenty of time for questions. And while we're waiting for people to line up, I wanted to ask if Marianne could maybe talk a little more about how the standard form was developed, because that seems like it could be something that's challenging to get agreement on with different plans.
Oh, sure, I'm happy. Actually, I was just thinking we probably should have put it up on the screen. It was the Adult Vaccine Administration record was based on the DPH form, and again, it was a coalition group. We sat around a room. And the health plans and public health departments and MassPro and myself sat around and just decided what did we need to have on the form that we could use across the board, across the state. You know, what was the minimal information we needed? Nothing unnecessary on the form. And because it's a reimbursement program for seniors, we actually listed out, we had the six Medicare Advantage programs, and then we added Medicare on so that it would apply to all seniors. And look, when you look at the form, it's, you know, basic demographic information. There's a line for each program, sort of pre-printed the name and a box, and they just, you know, figure out which card they need the information from, write it in, and that's it. So it's really, it was just a very basic form, but it's standard, and we really, as Patrick said, we allow no changes because it took us a long time to get to a standard form, which everybody wants. And then all of a sudden at the next meeting they said, oh, and can we add our logo? No. Can we add these questions? No. Can we tell them about the library fair? No.
The only thing I'd add to that is, as you know, you have to collect information on the lot number and manufacturer. All, and so this is printed at the bottom, and what we recommend is put that information in on your master form and then just make copies of that so you're not having to rewrite that for every form that you use. And that, again, has simplified the process for them.
Hi, I'm Laura Hurley. I'm an internist from Denver. And I had a couple of questions for the first group. One of which...
That's me.
Okay, yes. I'm a little embarrassed to even have to ask it. I'm not really clear on what a community agency is. And if you guys could maybe list for us, the audience, what might comprise a community agency. And I don't, should I wait for my, can I ask two questions, Megan?
Yeah, well let's do one at a time.
Okay.
Then go back to the line.
Okay.
No. As I mentioned, because we have 350 cities and towns, they all have health departments. For the most part, the community agencies are a local board of health.
Okay.
But we also included VNAs, or home health agencies, because in some of the towns are so small, they don't, in fact, provide immunizations to their seniors. They contract that out to a local VNA. Okay. So I would say 95% of those 140-plus participants are local boards of health, and the rest are local VNAs or home health agencies. Question number two.
And then I'll stop. Are you thinking of expanding your program to include other vaccines besides pneumococcal and influenza vaccine?
And not at this point. Again, I think the emphasis, because of the way the local boards of health operate and most of the immunizations that they provide, are coming from the State Department of Public Health, and they get pneumococcal and they get the influenza vaccine for free. So those were the two areas that we focused on. And I think if we can just do that, and as you know, these are often done in clinic settings. They're not done one-on-one coming into an office. 95% of this work is done on clinics that they hold. So to try and do it with other vaccines and pulling people away from their medical home, I think would not only complicate issues, but would be much more problematic for the health plan, because again, they would have to try and get that information into their own database, and that would be complicated.
Carrie Rovig, Nevada Immunization Coalition. Thank you all for your presentations. That was really interesting and helpful. We've anecdotally heard similar information to what your study found, that providers aren't stocking because of reimbursement, and many patients aren't getting those vaccines because of cost. And you had mentioned that some of the providers said they didn't carry the vaccines because they felt their patients could get them elsewhere. Where did they mention where elsewhere would be?
No, we didn't ask them to say where else. In the comment field, though, for the question with all the individual vaccines, several folks wrote in things like, we just send them to the local health department, or some people would say, you know, we don't regularly stock this, but we can get it if we need it pretty fast. Like, since, okay, but the patients still have to come back, or else you're really thinking about this ahead of time. And particularly for Zoster, folks said they can write a prescription for their patients to go to the pharmacy and then come back to have it administered to the doctor's office. So again, those were just comment fields, and we haven't really, but in terms of specifically saying this is, you know, it could be another doctor's office, it could be their local public health office, something like that.
Thank you. Any other suggestions on increasing reimbursement or working with insurance companies to fix reimbursement issues? Does anyone have ideas?
Well, I know that that's something that the NVAC is working on very hard right now, so they're going to come up with some brilliant solutions, I just know.
Excellent. Thank you.
I thought this a very interesting way of practicing medicine. Maybe doctors should have a list of procedures that they don't do because the reimbursement rate is too low. I'm not sure I understand why. There are other things they don't like because the reimbursement rate is low. Vaccinations, I mean, we know how profoundly important they are. And I think if you're getting so many of the docs who have found a way, I always question this idea of I can't afford it when so many other doctors have figured out a way. I would have be curious if they even know in some cases what the reimbursement rate is, or talk to docs who have figured out how to effectively provide those immunizations in their settings that others have been able to do effectively. It's a very lame excuse, I'm sorry.
It's coding. I'm Peggy Howe from Oklahoma, Tulsa Area Immunization Coalition. I'd just like to get your ideas on this. If you look at the adult schedule under the notes part, it says under hepatitis A and B and maybe some other ones, and anyone who wants to be protected from that disease. So that's pretty much any adult. And you know, if you can take that as grounds for immunizing every adult, then you probably, if you coded it right, could, you know, if you immunized every adult that walked into your clinic, you would be able to, you know, possibly at least break even, if not make money, including an administrative fee. So just like your thoughts on that.
You first.
There are models that are out there. MassPro is a quality improvement organization. You have them in all your states, and our focus is on Medicare beneficiaries, looking for the best practices that are out there, and then trying to get others to emulate them. You know, I was thinking, if you've got a variety, if a doctor is saying it gets problematic to provide all these immunizations, well, you know, one of the things that they could consider, why don't they have, when they have an annual flu clinic, which they could have, and you know, invite all their patients in to get a flu shot at specified times, review their immunizations at that time. You're going to minimize then the administrative time because you're already there for one shot. Get a couple of others while you're there, and I think that's a reasonable way of beginning to approach this. The other thing that strikes me when Ann's data said that some of their patients don't ask for it or don't want it. The most important reason for getting a flu shot, I know, is the recommendation from a physician. If they have patients that don't want it, it's their job to educate them about the importance of getting it. To have seniors not want to get zoster is crazy. I mean, this is something that they should all be getting. They're not taking the time. That's what it takes. It's taking time. HPV is another one. It takes time to convince people to do this. And I would also look at who is providing it. You know, doctors certainly, the last person I want to give me a flu shot is a doctor to begin with. Mm-hmm. If there are nurses there, you know what I'm talking about. We don't want them to do that. We want nurses to do it who do it all the time. Do they need to change the way in which they are, again, carrying out the systematic implementation of immunization programs in their office settings? The other could be, do they work closely with their local health departments or regional health departments? There may be ways of linking. If they don't want to do it, they should be linking with someone very closely to say, I don't have that, but you can, before you leave here, I'll set up an appointment at the health department where you can get that shot, assumingly they're offered there. If they're offered somewhere else and they don't want to do it, they should certainly make sure their patients are going to get it somewhere else.
We do have a physician that is starting an immunization clinic where if family medicine, internal medicine, if you don't want to stock and keep vaccines in your practice, you can just write a prescription for whatever your patient needs and send them to this clinic, and it will be an immunization clinic that's available all the time for them. So that's one way to do it. So.
Right. One more question.
Raphael Harpaz, CDC. A question for Ann. Yeah. Say something about geographic heterogeneity about some of your outcomes?
Well, that we haven't looked at that in terms of like actually doing some bivariates by region or anything like that. Is that what you're thinking of? We haven't, other than to verify that the respondents preserve kind of the random nature of being spread across the nation, which we do look at, but then taking it further, to see how some of those variables might differ. We haven't looked at that.
But you have that data available mm-hmm. then. Okay, thank you.
Okay, can we have a round of applause for our presenters, please?